With that, thank you, and
good morning. Today is October 19th, and it's 9:35, and I'm calling this meeting of the San Anca Bay Restoration Commission Governing Board to order. Caitlin, I'd like to go over the meeting procedures.
Yes, thank you, Chair. One moment, please. Okay, so we're first of all grateful to Hyperion for hosting us here today and to have the support of AGP staff. If you need restrooms, they're just around the corner to the left. If you need Wi-Fi, there are signs on these pillars in the front room. It is LA San Guest. You can use username LA San. The password is Clean LA 2025. Capital C, capital L, capital A. Okay, so this meeting will be held in a hybrid format in which we will have members participating in person and as well as the public. And we will have some people joining us via Zoom. At this point in time, we do not have any members joining us over Zoom. For those participating remotely, if you need technical support connecting to or using the Zoom meeting platform, please email it@agpvideo.com. So now I'll provide some information on how public participation will be organized for today's meeting. Members of the public may request a comment in the following ways. If you're in person, please fill out a speaker card located at the table in the front of the room and just give that to myself or Luke Ginger here, and we'll help facilitate your request for comment. If you're participating via Zoom, you can raise your hand virtually when we reach the item under which you'd like to speak. The raise hand function is at the bottom of the screen on the Zoom app, and if you're calling in over the phone, dial *9 to raise your hand and *6 to unmute yourself. This meeting is being recorded in live stream, so we ask that you please speak clearly and please turn on your microphones when you speak and turn it off when you finish speaking for those of you joining us in person. So that concludes the overview of meeting logistics. Chair, I recommend we move to item 1 for public comment.
Could you do the roll call first?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Thank you, Chair. Okay, so I will call members in order, in alphabetical order by last name. Please feel free to state your affiliation when I call your name. Marcella Benavides.
Hello, LA County Public Works, representing Director Mark Pistrella.
Jonathan Bishop.
Here, representing the State Water Resource Control Board.
Philip Brock.
Hi. City of Santa Monica, Bayona Creek, Watershed Cities.
I'm sorry, Member Brock, do you mind facing your name card out? Thank you so much.
I thought it was two-sided.
Charlie Casperi.
Charlie Casperi, representing Las Virgenes Municipal Water District.
Gabriela Cepeda Rizzo.
Here, representing Chevron, alternate for Jeff Wilson.
Megan Cooper.
Hi, I'm here with the California State Coastal Conservancy.
Tom Ford.
Tom Ford, Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program Director.
Dean Francois.
Here, Dean Francois, representing South Bay Cities, council member from Hermosa Beach. And some of the microphones aren't working. Like, I hardly have trouble here. I have trouble hearing some of them, so.
Okay.
Yeah, can we turn the volume up? Thank you.
Okay, thank you for letting us know. Barack Camelgard.
Hi, yeah, Barack Camelgard, representing LA Waterkeeper, alternate for Bruce Resnick.
Dan Murphy.
Dan Murphy, Los Angeles County Fire Department, Lifeguard Division.
Aaron Ordway.
Present, representing Supervisor Lindsay Horvath.
Catherine Peace.
Hi, present, representing Gila Bay.
Randy Rodriguez.
Good morning, Randy Rodriguez, representing California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Clark Stevens.
Good morning, representing Resource Conservation District of the Santa Monica Mountains at-large member.
Martha Tremblay.
Good morning, Martha Tremblay, LA County Sanitation District's alternate for Robert Ferrante.
And Claire Wagner.
Claire Wagner, alternate for Jonathan Bishop.
Erica Yelensky.
Good morning, Erica Yelensky with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Thank you. I believe I called all of our members, so that should conclude member roll call.
Thank you very much, Caitlin. And we can go on to public comment. Public comment is the time and place in the agenda for comments on items that are not on the agenda. As our normal practice, there'd be 4 minutes total time allotted for comments on in public comment and for the any items. Caitlin, do we have a anyone requesting public comment?
We received one request in advance. Marsha Hanscom, but I do not see her joining us via Zoom or in person at this time. She did request a comment on items 1 and 4B later on in the agenda.
So unless there's some objection, if she joins late, I would suggest we allow her at the appropriate time. We won't break into an item, but just the next break between items to allow her to speak in public form. Okay, seeing no objections, we will move on. Does anyone propose any changes to the order of the agenda? Seeing none, staff doesn't propose any. We will move on to the report from the chair. Due to an error in noticing, the executive committee meeting was an informal meeting because we didn't get the notice out at the right way and didn't put it as voting items, but we did meet and at that it heard some updates from the staff and from the foundation, and we staff developed an agenda by coordinating with me and other executive committee meetings by email. I think that's all I needed to say on that. If there are no questions, we will move on to report from the TAC. Luke, could you provide an update?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning, everyone. Our TAC chair and vice chair were not able to attend today's meeting, so I will provide the update. The TAC has not met since the governing board's last meeting in August, and the next TAC meeting is scheduled for December 4th. The agenda will include establishing a timeline for the State of the Bay report chapters, confirming TAC memberships, as well as discussing new candidates for TAC membership, which will be brought to the governing board for consideration of appointment in February 2024. So far, we have a candidate with expertise in coastal engineering and another with expertise in coastal ecosystem services. That concludes the TAC updates.
Thank you. We move right on, Luke, to report from the Chief Administrator.
Thank you, Chair. The Governing Board last met on August 17th, and during that meeting, the Commission heard from LA Sanitation on the Westwood Neighborhood Greenway Project and from Gila the Bay regarding their river report card. This is now the second Governing Board meeting conducted in person after pandemic-related meeting requirements were changed several months ago. Those requirements have changed yet again with the recent passing of Senate Bill 544. Those requirements go into effect in 2024, so we will provide updates at the next meeting. I now have some updates on what Commission staff have been working on in the past few months. In September, Commission staff helped the Bay Foundation submit the NEPORT to the US EPA. The NEPORT is an online report on the amount of habitat restored and protected in the National Estuary Program, as well as the funding leveraged during the fiscal year. Staff are currently assisting the Bay Foundation submit the fiscal year 2023 annual report for the National Estuary Program that is getting submitted to the US EPA by October 31st. The annual report contains updates on the actions that make up the CCMP. Commission staff and the Bay Foundation will present on the annual report at the February 2024 Governing Board meeting after the US EPA reviews the report. Statewide redistricting has changed SMBRC membership eligibility for some elected officials. Therefore, we need to update the Commission's Memorandum of Understanding, or MOU, which defines the governance structure and memberships of the Commission. Staff have been working on updating the MOU, and we hope to bring it to the Governing Board for consideration of approval by December of 2023 or early 2024. Commission staff have continued to work on executing four of the six Proposition 50 funded projects that were approved in 2022. We plan on having all projects executed by the end of the year. We are currently reviewing study designs and quality control procedures for two of the projects that have been executed already. That's Occidental College's Rocky Reef Study and Squirps Wetland Study. Commission staff are currently planning the informational topics to be presented at future Governing Board meetings. We have distributed a survey to the Executive Committee members who will be helping us pick topics for those meetings. We hope to have those survey results by December. And in terms of Public Records Act, the Santa Monica Bay Restoration Commission has not received any public records requests since the last Governing Board meeting. Now I have a few updates on work items coming up in the near future. So the Governing Board is scheduled to hold elections for its at-large seats in December. I encourage all members currently in those seats to consider serving another term. We always appreciate your participation, and we really value what you bring to the Commission, so please consider another term. I also need to mention that we currently have one vacant at-large seat, so please reach out to your partners or other folks who you think would be interested in joining the Governing Board. We will be distributing information on nomination and election procedures in advance of that meeting, so please keep an eye out for those materials. And while we're on the topic of elections, I need to remind you all that if any members vacate their seats, you must submit a statement of economic interest. You may also know that as Form 700. You must submit that within 30 days of vacating your seat. That also applies to folks assuming office. So you must submit that Form 700 within 30 days of assuming office. That also includes alternates. So please let Commission staff know promptly if your membership changes or if your alternates change. The US EPA will be conducting a program evaluation for the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program, which takes place every 5 years. The evaluation will begin in early 2024 and conclude in fall 2024. Commission staff will coordinate with the Bay Foundation to compile information for that evaluation, and preliminary findings for that program evaluation will be presented to the Governing Board next summer. The US EPA requires revisions to the Comprehensive Conservation and Management Plan, or CCMP, every 5 years to incorporate progress updates on the CCMP actions. And we hope to begin that revision process in early 2024. So these are two separate processes. One is an update to the CCMP, one is a program evaluation. And the Governing Board and Executive Committee will be asked to provide guidance and input on potential updates and consider approval of those CCMP updates next year. Finally, I want to remind you all, you'll hear this multiple times during this meeting, that our next Governing Board meeting is Thursday, December 14th at the Delray Yacht Club. So it's a week earlier than we typically have it, and it's at a different location than we are currently. That concludes my updates.
Thank you, Luke. Now it's time for Tom to give us some updates. from the foundation.
Thank you, John. Ooh, Dean, can you hear that? I'm gonna lean back here a little. All righty. Thank you for that. I'd just checking off several things on my list that Luke already addressed. One moment, please. All right. So it's on the agenda later, but in addition to some of the deliverables that this program has put together over the past few months and having acquired approval just at the end of September for the equity strategy, we're excited to present to you elements of that plan later today. And Caitlin, I haven't had a chance to look at the website. Did you folks get that posted for everybody already? All right. So if there's interest in the equity strategy, you can find that at smbrc.ca.gov, and we'll get it up on our other web pages shortly.
Sorry, I misheard. We did not post the equity strategy okay. yet. I was thinking of the NEP's fiscal year 2022 annual report. Apologies.
All right. Well, so then it's just a teaser. You'll have to wait, and we'll get it up very soon. But I'll be presenting on some of the substance of that report to you later today. Similarly, now that this program is functioning on its standard NEP support, which comes through Section 320 of the Clean Water Act, in addition, we now have bipartisan infrastructure law funds that are moving through this operation to further the CCMP and to devote flow of those benefits to disadvantaged communities. So we'll have other reporting to complete for that BIL program funds that mirrors a lot of what we do for this other funding stream that we've long enjoyed the benefits of. So you'll be hearing from me about annual reports for BIL. We'll have NEPORT as well to update and inform, and then we'll make you folks aware of those reports once they've gone to the EPA, been vetted, approved, and then we'll make them available for the public. And that's unfortunate, sorry. And then the State of the Bay report, this is a compendium. I know that Luke just mentioned this in advance of our TAC. Just due to some conflicts with some folks' schedules, we did not get the website up yet. I had fully expected to have that done by this point in time this month, but it'll be done by the end of the month, and then we'll have something to look at. So we may want to consider having an item about that in the near future so we can orient people to the new State of the Bay webpage and some of that structural changes that we've been discussing at the TAC. Roughly, it takes a big lift at this point in time with the level of sophistication that so many of the partners bring to environmental monitoring in this area, in addition to what the Bay Foundation conducts. And it's a lot to go through. And for us to kind of hit the brakes, I think every 3 to 5 years to dedicate that effort to do the entirety of the State of the Bay has been a challenge. So the TAC's been trying to figure out how we could maybe take smaller serial bites at these monitoring intervals. So we're going to give it a try and see if we can start producing roughly annual updates to given habitats and have that roll through in a serial manner. So more to come on that, as well as an anticipated schedule of which habitat updates we would see first, second, third over the next few years. All righty. Last thing, I'm happy to announce that some of the quality assurance project plans that are informed for any of the data that we generate that says, hey, did that work or did that not work, especially if we're utilizing EPA funding. So quality assurance project plans, I know that the state has similar programs and requires similar reporting in order to inform methodology and make sure that everybody's got high confidence in the results of these types of studies and their outputs. So we've got two more that have gone through EPA and need a few more signatures, and that is one for looking at intertidal mussels and the stress that they experience due to changes in salinity and temperature. And at that point in time, we can start to take apart where we might start to see a tipping point for some of these mussels. They provide a very strong foundational element for intertidal communities, especially rocky intertidal communities. And if we start to lose our mussels, we start to lose a lot of the structure and the function that make those habitats important. So we're trying to get a good bead on the trajectory of our mussels and our rocky intertidal, and that QAP gets us going in that direction. Harmful algal blooms certainly have made an impact this year. Not entirely surprising with the amount of rain that we had, with the high wave energy that we experienced at the earliest part of 2023, moves a lot of nutrients, stirs up a lot of sediments. And we saw that concerns for the potential of domoic acid building up inside California spiny lobster, that we saw a delay for the opening of that fishery this year. For those of you that pay attention to those matters, it's been several years where they had to close down or delay the Dungeness crab fishery further north, up in usually around the Monterey, Half Moon Bay area. So now we're starting to see some of those same concerns, I think, manifest down here in Southern California. So happy that we've got a QAP. Helps us move forward with our plans to do more monitoring and get some results built into some models to help us figure out what's going on. We'll see. There's a couple proposals out there to help us fuel some modeling and some further data collection. In addition to sharing the terrific work that this body conducts here in Los Angeles with you, I get to share it with other folks around the country often as well. And formally, twice a year with the Association of National Estuary Programs, the US EPA, we have a fall tech transfer, which will be occurring next month in Portland. Expect all of the National Estuary Programs to participate. I'll be making a few presentations there on some of the things that you just heard. In addition, I'll be presenting to the Restore America's Estuaries folks, which is a compendium of coastal resource managers regarding the eelgrass work that we've been able to get off the ground with everyone's support here. And it is not too soon for us to be preparing for our spring meeting. Last year, we had hoped that we were going to be able to open up a hybrid format for that spring meeting, so that instead of trying to travel to DC and trying to get in through security clearances into the federal buildings, et cetera, a lot of obstacles, obviously, for folks to participate directly in that. We're planning for that spring meeting now with the tumult, I think I'll use, to describe what's going on in the U.S. Congress. Planning for this event's been very challenging. So I don't have a whole lot of specifics to share with you other than we're trying to move in the window that we currently have open to us while the federal government is still open for business into about mid-November to see how much progress we can make. If we can get some hybrid opportunities going so we can communicate out further with the proceedings of that this year. I know a lot of us would love to take that opportunity. Right now, I expect us to be looking at issues surrounding managed retreat, coastal resilience, and I think what we've seen amongst national estuary programs nationwide is that we've been focused and continue to focus on water quality and the benefits that that yields to the ecosystems as well as to public benefit. But the physical environment is starting to unravel with climate change around us, with sea level rise, coastal erosion, coastal flooding, and increasingly we see folks spending more and more time on those efforts. So we're trying to make sure that we're tooling up smartly, finding other potential partnerships within the federal agencies to make sure that we're benefiting from best practices and lessons learned. And now finally, sort of closer to home. If I would start with our environmental engagement program, was at an event and unfortunately had to leave a little early yesterday, but we were up in Pacoima in LA City Council District number 7 with Monica Rodriguez and her staff, and specifically with good folks at the Pupusaria Cuscatlan, and I hope I'm getting that close to correct. Cuscatlan is a great word. And so anyway, the the point of this one was that they're participating in our in the reusable LA program, which is investing in small restaurants to help them move away from single-use disposable plastics using more durable materials. The city of LA is making investments into these businesses to help these folks, and through some of the outreach and audits that are undertaken, we're able to build a body of communication that shows other restaurants that they can do this, that they're saving money, improving their profit margins, and doing better for their communities and their environment. So that was a hoot being there. On the other end of the of town, here in the South Bay area, a number of the environmental charter school systems that we've been able to engage with are having their fall harvest ceremony. So the composting has gone into the gardens, the vegetables have been grown, and now they're starting to have their fall harvest festivals across those campuses. So it's great to see the full arc of that happening this year. Moving on with our coastal adaptation program, we are busily finalizing a number of annual of reports from this past year. All that rain led to a lot of vegetation growth. Some of that was welcome vegetation, others of it less so. So we were very busy keeping up with that and trying to get prepared for this upcoming wet season. So we're still producing reports, still getting them in, and I appreciate everybody's patience on the receiving end of those as we've been delayed in getting those out this year. But we are in the spirit of tuning up for this coming wet season. This is a time for us to start putting plants back out in the ground, getting seeds back out into the ground, and our volunteer events on the weekends will be ramping up as well. So appreciate all the support we've been getting from various municipalities around the Bay for that. Moving on to things in the ocean, continuing to advance kelp forest restoration off of Palos Verdes. Was invited to support the state of California's kelp recovery management plan. So myself and others are serving the Department of Fish and Wildlife to help them understand what they would like to set up as priorities and what practitioners understand to further kelp forest restoration and management in the state. Our endangered white abalone went out into the ocean last week. Our team is diving, well, the waves I think are keeping us out tomorrow. To be determined. We might be underwater tomorrow. If not, it'll be early next week. Checking on the health and condition of those abalone that were just put out there, and we'll be feeding them as well. So that's going great. We'll be off of Catalina Island on the 30th of this month, taking a look at an eelgrass transplant out there that's been very fruitful thus far. We're interested in catching a shot of that right before we start heading into the wintertime. When less light makes it down to the ocean floor, the grasses themselves start to diminish and they kind of retreat into their substrate structure. So we'll be taking a look at that end of this month. And then similarly, near end of this month and a bit further from home, we'll be out at San Miguel Island in the Northern Channel Islands, surveying for red abalone to see what their population structure looks like out there. And the intent of this is to start to identify source populations for red abalone, to move them into an aquaculture system, to breed more red abalone, to get those back out on the reefs off of Santa Barbara County to undo some of the damages from the Refugio oil spill. So that's some of what's going on at this point in time.
Thank you, Tom. Any questions for Tom? Seeing none.
We yes, did please. Have a request for public comment under this item, if we'd like to move to that before sure. Member comment. Okay. Walter, I will allow you to speak. And if I could have Chris or Dakota load the 4-minute timer, please. Okay, Walter, you now have the floor.
Thank you, Caitlin. Good morning, everyone. Walter Lamb at the Bino Wetlands Land Trust. Some pretty big information has just come out really in the last couple of days about the Bino Wetlands. And then, of course, there's the information that we've been, you know, trying to get for quite a long time. And so I'll try to tie those two things together. I think first, California Department of Fish and Wildlife is seeking an additional $2.8 million to basically do the same work that was funded in 2007, fully funded in 2007, then funded again in 2012. And then in 2021, there was an acknowledgement that there was a miscalculation about how much money was needed in 2012. So they needed another $1.69 million. And that was 2.5 years ago. And then now they're going for another $2.8 million to revise the EIR, but also to apparently push forward with two sequences of the project while they're doing the EIR, which seems a little pre-decisional. They also put out a timeline, but the timeline is only for a commencement of what they're calling the first two sequences of the project. It isn't quite accurate, but sort of rolling with that, how they're describing it. And even that timeline seems unattainable to us, and happy to explain why when we have more time. And so, you know, you were the agency that was really the lead local agency. I know your state, locally based state agency. And, you know, back in, you know, 2013, Shelley Luce, your then executive director, was, you know, pointing out that you were the local face of the project, and then you just kind of disappeared from it, which is, you have a resolution out there from 2012 promising to stay engaged until the end, and you haven't rescinded that, but it just kind of went, you know, into the wastebasket, I guess. And that's really been a problem. That leadership vacuum is probably the single most important factor as to what happened here. And so I just want to touch on a couple of the director's comments. You know, in terms of working really hard and struggling to get reports out on time, you know, I understand that. We get stuff out late, newsletters and whatnot. The problem is with some of the projects that we're talking about that have gone so far over budget and so far over schedule, the only information we get is that annual report. And so it used to be, the one for Bione used to come out at the end of July or, you know, early August. And last year it slipped to October 14th. And now I can't even get a response. I'm just putting in this inquiry. It's in your work plan. That's the deliverable, right? For the community engagement project, the deliverable in your work plan is the annual report. That's problematic in its own right, because there's no deliverable, you know, to achieve a certain degree of native vegetation. I was at the site yesterday. There are some patches that look pretty good based on the limited amount of seeding and planting, but a lot of it looks really, really bad. I would say most of it looks, you know, highly questionable for a habitat restoration. You got places where somebody tried to deal with pampas grass, and now you've got pampas grass growing back in, along with euphorbia, number of other invasives. So I think what's so problematic here, and then we also have a request in to the chair and to your chief administrative director for this commission to take a non-regulatory position to actually do something about invasive vegetation throughout more of the reserve. The problem is, it seems like everybody now wants to not talk about the Bione wetlands. And until we talk about the Bione wetlands, we're just not going to solve these problems. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Walter. Good timing. Any other public comment? Thank you, Caitlin. We are now going to move on to item 2E, and I'm going to ask Luke to introduce this item. But, oh.
Do I just raise my hand by raising my hand?
You can just ask me that you want to say.
Okay. Sorry, questions for Tom, and then, sorry, you need the mic on. You got me. Okay, thank you. Sorry, I'm not used to this. And I need to speak into the mic. Got it. All right. Thank you. So I had a couple of questions, and they're not related. So one, how often do you have to go out to feed the baby abalone, and kind of what happens if it's too many waves and you can't go out? That's the first question. Should I ask the second or?
The feeding practices of baby abalone. Right. I was looking for a title for a book. All right. So we absolutely lavish them with food when they are with us in our laboratory in advance. So we got them as fattened up and as conditioned as we can. We give them ample food when we place them into these aquaculture pods. That would sustain them for a month, but we give them, we put them in there. We're back within 2 weeks to clear out that algae and replace it. And then our schedule is to have them have the opportunity to egress those containment areas when we open them 1 month after we've put them out into the water. So these animals have never been in the ocean. They've never experienced a lot of ocean things. Certainly don't have any familiarity with their predators. So the best we're trying to divine is whether or not we're giving them a chance to acclimate to that. It's the same food that they've been eating, so they readily take that up. And so far, it's been working pretty well. We're looking to collect more data. We're trying to enhance ways that we do collect data to better inform the success of those projects. The challenge being that there's very few endangered white abalone to work with, so their numbers are relatively small.
So Tom, can I interpret from that that you feed them about 2 weeks after?
Sorry, Jonathan. Yeah, I'm feeling talky, aren't I, today? 2 weeks they get fed, and then 1 month we feed them again, and then they can move on if they want.
Sorry about that. It's okay. Thank you. I'm looking forward to the children's story. So the next question about the event in Pacoima, you might have said this and I missed it. Do you know, are those restaurants now, like, this was the kickoff and they've switched from using disposables to reusables, or that's still forthcoming?
Yeah, there are a number of restaurants that are in the queue, and I think we're talking to upwards of about 80 of them right now. So the program is getting started. We are at the Bay Foundation, we're helping with outreach and some coordination, really just trying to get out there and make these folks aware of this program. The Pupusaria Cuscatlan is one of the first ones that's in this progression. So more results soon, and we'll have a better, you know, discernible handle on how many folks and restaurants are going through the entirety of the process.
Fabulous. Any other questions for Tom? Yes. Could you mute Walter, please?
Sorry.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you, Dean Francois. The previous public speaker spoke about the, this isn't a question for Tom. I guess it's directed to staff or the chair here. The previous speaker mentioned the Bayona Wetlands Ecologic Reserve restoration, and I was just wondering that with the recent lawsuits that have gone through, trying to get a gentler restoration, I guess they have decertified the EIR. So how does this commission get involved with the future and where we're going forward with the restoration program? Because as I understand, the Fish and Wildlife have already started a new timetable to go forward with restoration. I was just wondering how we're involved in that.
So first, I think we ought to look to Fish and Wildlife to give us an update on what they're doing. This commission, the governing board, can consider how they want to be involved. As you know, we're not a regulatory agency. We aren't going to tell Fish and Wildlife what to do, but we are able to provide our input and our advice on their process, on the what they're proposing, and we can work with the foundation to do scientific reviews of what they're doing. So right now, it's we don't have any active activities going on, but be happy to entertain thoughts from governing board members on how folks want to be involved and. Recognizing that we only have two staff people, so there's not a lot of technical involvement we can do, but we do have a relationship with the foundation to help us.
Well, we are funding those programs though, right?
I'd have to ask that, but I don't believe we are.
The California Department of Fish and Wildlife's Bayona Wetlands Restoration Project, the commission does not fund. We have it in our work plan as something that partners are implementing that further our goals. The Bay Foundation does have a community restoration project in a portion of the reserve for invasive species removal. That, I believe, is still funded by the federal NEP grant that the Bay Foundation receives, and that is part of our work plan as well. Does that clarify?
Somewhat. Could this be a future agenda item for this commission then?
So, yes, okay. Of course. We just need to have a better idea of what the added agenda item. So if we can work together on putting together an agenda item and what it would cover.
Okay, thank you.
So, sorry, could I mention one thing before you, Tom? We have reached out to CDFW for an update, so hopefully we'll have one in the coming months.
Yeah, Randy.
Thank you. There's a lot of discussion, and we have CDFW sitting right here. I, in response to the interest on this topic through the executive committee, through some of the comments, we are able to present on this topic at the December meeting, December 14th, excuse me, in any form that the governing board prefers, whether it be an update from the governing board member or whether it be a specific informational item. So that's out for your consideration, but we're prepared to do that in December.
Okay. Fabulous. So we'll work together. I think an information item would be appropriate at this time, looking at where things are and what the plan is to move forward.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. It would be similar to the access issue we had. We presented that in an information item back in October of last year, I believe. So look forward to that.
Okay. Tom?
Yeah, I just wanted to help clarify one point. The Bay Foundation does currently have some support for continued removal of invasive vegetation in Biona. That money is coming through the State Coastal Conservancy.
So, Tom, if we could ask at the same time for next board meeting to give a update on the progress and activities and of the invasive species removal and where it is and how it's working, and I think that would be useful at the same time as we're working with the. Update from the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Okay, any other comments or questions at this time for Tom? All right, I think we're ready to move on to item 2E. And before I turn it over to Luke, I just want to make one comment, an observation. In my time on this board, I've many times heard folks propose ideas and actions in the annual work plan, and the response has been, well, that's not in our CCMP, and so we need to update the CCMP before we can add that to our annual work plan. This is the opportunity coming up to amend our CCMP so that we can add in new items for our that will be then implemented through the work plans for 5 years over those times. So I really want folks to be thinking about this and using this opportunity, because I find it to be a somewhat a bureaucratic answer and a catch 22 to be in 2 years saying, you know, this would be great if we could do this, and we can't because we didn't put it into the CCMP. And so before I'm turning it over to Luke now to introduce this item and talk about it, but I wanted to give you my observations over time, and that this is something that is important for us to think about and to make the changes that we want to see as we move forward with our comprehensive monitoring plan. Luke?
Thank you, Chair. This next item is an invitation for members to provide updates on some of their organization's activities that contribute to the CCMP or its actions. So,
I was thinking of something else, so
Yeah, maybe we could revisit that at the next agenda item. But yeah, any members have updates they want to share?
Yes. Charlie with Las Virgenes Municipal Water District. We are proceeding with final interviews of three design build contractors for the construction of our full scale pure water plant to be located in Agoura Hills. This plant is going to take existing surplus purple pipe reclaimed water that we do not have uses for in the wintertime and convert that to drinking water, and it will go into our drinking water reservoir. We also have a memorandum of agreement with several neighboring agencies and cities to potentially treat non-storm related flows that make it into the creeks, Malibu Creek specifically, and that's the dirtiest water that goes into the creek, and we propose to blend that as part of our pure water plant supply. We also are proposing to treat some groundwater that does not meet potable water standards. And so this is all towards increasing water supply for the region. And we're really excited about the progress that we're making and expect to have water coming out of the plant late 2028. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie. Any other members? Catherine.
Hi, good morning. I have a few updates from Heal the Bay. In September was Coastal Cleanup Day, as many of you know, and I just wanted to report out on some of the successes from that day and actually week. So over the week of September 16th to 23rd, Heal the Bay organized 48 cleanups throughout LA County. 7,337 volunteers participated, and we all together removed 16,211 pounds of trash. So this was really a great effort. We were excited to have Department of Beaches and Harbors and the Ocean Conservancy host cleanups, as well as LA City Council members Tracy Park, Tim McCosker, and Katie Yaroslavsky. So appreciate all that support. Also wanted to just give an update on with the end of the legislative season, Heal the Bay co-sponsored two bills, which were signed into law by Governor Newsom. So one of the bills we co-sponsored with NRDC and Metropolitan Water District, AB 1572, which was authored by Assemblymember Laura Friedman. And this bill bans the use of drinking water for irrigation of non-functional turf. So this is includes things like medians, big grassy areas near shopping centers. This bill is expected to save as much as 300,000 acre feet of water per year, which is really exciting. We also worked on a bill co-sponsored with Resources Legacy Fund, AB 1611, which was authored by Assemblymember Lowenthal. And this bill improves how the state handles fishing violations. So lower level administrative violations can be handled kind of just as infractions and managed in local traffic courts, while those larger scale violations can be charged as misdemeanors. So this ensures that every violation faces a consequence, no matter the scale, while improving the equity of prosecuting fishing violations. And my final update is that tomorrow, Heal the Bay is very excited. We're being honored at LA City Council. We appreciate Councilwoman Tracy Park leading this effort. It's Heal the Bay Day in LA. So we'll be honored tomorrow at 10 a.m. in LA City Council. And this is really kind of celebrating the 20th anniversary of both our aquarium and our angler outreach program, where we educate anglers about DDT and PCB fish contamination. So anyone's invited, I can send you details if you're interested, 10 a.m. LA City Council, and you can join online or in person. So thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you, Chair. This is Aaron Nordauer representing LA County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath. I have a few updates for the group. I wanted to actually, given our discussion of zero waste, I just wanted to also acknowledge our host, LA Sanitation, for putting on an event with basically zero waste and compostable items, and you know, use that as something we can all strive to do as we continue to put on events ourselves. In Los Angeles County, an unincorporated LA County restaurants, full service restaurants today, should always be offering reusables for in-person dining. That's now law, and it's something we should all try to encourage. I mentioned in our last meeting that our office was leading work with a number of groups, including the Bake Foundation and others in this room, on a Living Shorelines initiative, basically deploying living shorelines to protect our coasts and applying for grant funding from the federal government. It's a very competitive federal funding landscape, and it looks like we are probably not going to be chosen for the federal funds that we had originally been going after. Unfortunately, we heard that there were $90 billion and 900 projects nationally that went after this. That said, we are still committed to deploying this project going forward and this program, and so we're going to be working with a number of state and federal partners to identify other funding resources. And I again open the door to all members of this community to work with us and be, you know, build the coalition to enhance our biodiversity and habitat along the shoreline while defending our beaches and coastline. I wanted to also mention that the county's Safe Clean Water Program, also known as Measure W, is also at a critical point this year. We are about to be, in the next couple months, reappointing members of all the 9 regional steering committees, as well as the scoring and regional oversight committees. The next month would be a great time for those who are interested stakeholders. There's lots of expertise in this room and those listening to express interest in joining and helping us to adaptively manage and lead this program to invest in water quality, water supply, and community benefits around LA County. And you can find out more at the website safecleanwaterla.org. You can also ask me or some of my peers here in the room who are involved. On this, just this week, Supervisor Horvath presented a motion at the Board of Supervisors declaring Oaktober in Los Angeles County, celebrating oak trees and what they represent for our local ecology, our cultural patrimony, our biodiversity, and our resiliency to climate. As part of that, since fall is really the ideal time to plant oak trees in our region, our LA County Fire Department is going to be hosting a oak tree seedling giveaway on Friday, November 3rd from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. That's located at 942 Las Virgenes Road. That's their Malibu forestry unit. And people can pick them up there. There's also an opportunity to make an appointment to pick up another time by calling 818-222-1108. And then my final update is related to that. On the next day, on Saturday, November 4th, from 9 to 11:30, my office is going to be partnering with a number of nonprofits to put on a Topanga Community Conservation Day. This is going to be located in the View Ridge Estates community in the Santa Monica Mountains. It's going to be focused on conservation and environmental quality of our local ecosystems throughout the Santa Monica Mountains. It's going to be an interactive event where folks of the members of the public can learn about water quality projects and the taking place. You can pick up resources on composting, rain barrels, get a free white sage plants while supplies last. And some of our partners there are LA County Public Works, the Regional Water Control District, SME Board, Heal the Bay, Caltrout, and other community partners. And I hope that you'll be able to join us at one or more of those events. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron. Any other updates from members? Martha.
Hi, everyone. Martha Tremblay with LA County Sanitation Districts. And my report is the action, I think it's action 23, similar to what Charlie reported. That's the action related to reducing our reliance of imported water. The county sanitation districts have a partnership with the Metropolitan Water District to produce 150 million gallons of purified water, water that's currently going out to the ocean from our Carson facility. This water would be purified and used for groundwater recharge in the region. We continue our CEQA process. We're in the environmental phase. We're a bit delayed, but we are still scheduled to be done with that in 2024. On November 2nd, the Pure Water Demonstration Facility, which we've been operating now for a couple of years, will be renamed the Grace Napolitano Innovation Center in honor of the Congresswoman who has been a champion for water in our region. And then on the side note, the sanitation district is celebrating 100 years of service this year, and we're actually planning on renaming the Joint Water Pollution Control Plant in Carson to better reflect what we currently do. So we'll have a ceremony next week to rename that facility to eliminate the pollution from its name, and it'll actually be the A.K. Warren Resource, Water Resource Facility, to better reflect what we currently do. And, you know, the Pure Water Southern California is the last piece for us in terms of seeing that water fully recycled. So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other updates?
Just a quick question for Martha, if I may. Martha? Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. I'm just curious, that 150 million gallons that you spoke about, how frequently do you intend to produce that 150 million gallons?
Well, the project is to produce up to 150 million gallons of flow per day. So currently the facility produces about 240 million gallons that goes to the ocean. So we're proposing to produce up to 150.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other reports, we will move on to our one business item, which is to approve the minutes from the August 17th board meeting. I understand there's one correction. Is that correct, Caitlin?
Yes, staff is proposing one correction. I can share the minutes on the screen if that's helpful. Sorry, there's a bit of a delay. So we're proposing one correction to the public attendees on page 7 to add Jacqueline Landbrix. Apologies for that omission before.
Any other comments, concerns on the minutes? Catherine?
I just noticed that it said remote only meeting, and we did have that in person. That was my only change.
Thank you for that. I can add the meeting. I can change that to the Del Rey Yacht Club.
Any other edits needed? Okay, I would entertain a motion. Oh, Eric?
Nothing yet.
I'll move to approve.
With the?
I'll second.
With the proposed edits?
Changes. Yes. With the changes.
Thank you. Caitlin, can you do a roll call vote?
Apologies. That was Catherine who moved and Martha who seconded?
That's correct.
No. Oh.
Oh. Sorry?
I thought it was me.
Okay.
But that, I don't, that's fine.
That's fine. I was looking around. So. Do you have that?
Phil and Martha.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. I will call members in alphabetical order by last name for the vote on the minutes. Okay, Marcela Benavides.
Yes.
Apologies. my screen. I need to adjust my screen. Okay, thank you for your patience. Jonathan Bishop?
Aye.
Oh, I'm sorry. One moment, please. Okay, there we go. Phil Brock?
Yes.
Thank you. Charlie Casper?
Yes.
Gabriela Cepeda Rizzo.
Yes.
Megan Cooper.
Abstain.
Dean Francois.
Yes.
Barack Kemmelgard.
Yes.
Dan Murphy.
Abstain.
Aaron Ordower.
Aye.
Catherine Peace.
Yes.
Randy Rodriguez?
Yes.
Clark Stevens?
Yes.
Martha Tremblay?
Yes.
Thank you. The minutes are approved as revised.
Thank you. So I'm going to suggest we have a quick 10-minute break before we come back for our two information items. Thank you all. We reconvene at 10:45. Okay. Thank you all. I think we will get started again, and we'll move on to item 4A. Luke, can you introduce this item?
Thank you, Chair. Tom Ford will now present on the equity strategy, which has been drafted by the Bay Foundation for the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law, that's BIL, the BIL funding they received. The equity strategy details how the NEP will contribute to the Biden administration's Justice 40 initiative. The initiative requires that at least 40% of BIL funds benefit underserved communities. The equity strategy was emailed to members along with the agenda, so hopefully some of you have had a chance to review it. One thing to clarify is that the equity strategy has already been approved by the US EPA, and this commission was not required to consider its approval. So with that, I will hand it over to Tom.
Thank you very much, Luke. Appreciate that. And okay, there it is. There it is. Great. So my intention is to orient you all to the direction that was given to us by the US EPA to satisfy the equity strategy, as well as identify its major components, and then to take you through the projects that this body considered and approved in August of 2022, and show you what this looks like for us moving forward as we try to follow through on the intentions of this, which is to not only estimate the flow of benefits to disadvantaged communities while we achieve a furtherance of the CCMP and focus on climate resilience, but also feeding back into that loop to see, you know, how close we actually do deliver on this. And I think there's some really exciting potentials in this strategy as it plays out. If I could get that next slide, that'd be great. All right. Thank you. The EPA has a strategic plan. They developed this frequently. But I don't think there's necessarily a requirement per se that they update their strategic plan at any given interval. I would say from my experience, it seems to be updated with changes in administration and priorities within those administrations. What we were able to draw from for this moment with the strategic plan was that, you know, we've been asked, and the EPA is, themselves is assigning this responsibility says to tackle the climate crisis and to take decisive action to advance environmental justice and civil rights. So I think that this aligned very closely with the Biden administration's interests through their Justice 40 initiative, which is also part of the architecture that informs this strategic plan. Get to that next slide, please, Caitlin. Or I'm not sure who's advancing slides. Yes, thank you. The long-term plan and the equity strategy. So these were coupled with one another this past year. We were intended to develop a five-year plan for developing projects and budget and expenditures for BIL funds here in the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program study area, largely coastal Los Angeles County. We had identified 8 projects that we would like to advance, and part of the long-term strategy required the long-term plan, required the equity strategy to be completed as well. All that had to get in by June 1, 2023. I'm happy to say we got that in there on time, and that we were expecting this equity strategy to focus on how you could make sure that 40% of the benefits of these investments were going to disadvantaged communities. So we submitted that plan. It had been in review, and we went back and forth a few times with EPA Region 9 as well as headquarters trying to improve that product, clarify some of their questions. And we recently received the approval end of September. I'm sorry, I didn't bring the date in front of me. I think it was the 28th, but I could be wrong. Something along those lines. Next slide, please. Some of the guidance within the equity strategy that was directed towards us was, defining disadvantaged communities. I think the EPA recognized that there's a number of ways that a community would define disadvantaged, and they gave us discretion to define disadvantaged communities. I think our staff at the Bay Foundation quickly looked around the room and said, well, we don't have those expertise. So how do you define disadvantaged communities? And I would say, fortunately, we were able to pull from the resources made available through the state of California through Senate Bill 535, which also resulted in the creation of CalEnviro Screen 4.0, which is a lovely web portal to look at census blocks that have been identified as disadvantaged. And I'll have a slide later on as to some of those criteria that bill used to define disadvantaged communities. A baseline was also generated. This was done by the EPA to take a look at our past investments and see how they corresponded with EPA's tools for identifying disadvantaged communities and say how we had done with our investments in the past. So that was completed. What we are expected to do is not just define, but do an analysis of these disadvantaged communities. We have numeric targets associated with these projects. So each project has its budget, and then the quotient of that given project to see if that 40% threshold is met. This would be a good time for me to remind myself that the entire National Estuary Program, the 28 programs, the regions that support them, are being looked at in aggregate to hit this 40% target of the overall investment through BIL. Apologies, that's a little bit out of order. Couple of things that I think come down very true and close to home very directly are key activities and our ability to track these benefits. I'll elucidate to you what those are and how we plan on hoping to best track the flow of these benefits to communities. Next slide, please. Oh, thank you. The BIL funds, as I said, was climate resilience, advancing your CCMP, John's favorite document, looking to get that updated,
and also that flow of benefits to disadvantaged communities. So for this breakdown that was provided, again, out of a memorandum that circulated July 2022, now 40%, this is my slide photo to remind me to remind you that you know, climate was the place where we felt like we could do some of our most impactful work. And that is in response to the amazing support that disadvantaged communities do receive in Los Angeles. The investments being made through LA City, LA County Public Works, some of the other municipalities have our investments on the scales of hundreds of millions of dollars. In this case, we're looking at $4.5 million coming to us to use within our study area. So we really, I think, tried to take some, you know, really smart shots at what we could be able to do to add to those other considerable efforts. So you'll see a lot of coastal projects. You'll see a lot of work on coastal resilience with an absolute recognition and understanding that we are hopefully promoting access and providing recreation and sustainability and resilience to this coastline through these projects. More to come on that as we walk through this. Next slide, please. So our project equity targets, expanded adaptive capacity of disadvantaged communities to be resilient to climate change, improved wildlife habitat, increased disadvantaged communities' access to recreation, expanded education or deepened engagement or representation of disadvantaged communities. And what we did in that equity strategy was for each one of the projects, we built a nice little matrix of these project equity targets. We spell them out in the strategy itself, and we assign which ones of these targets we think are being met within a given project that we've placed in the strategy. So a couple more slides down the road and it'll all start to come together for you. Next one, please. And so then the key activities. So we have equity targets and then key activities. So this is the, you know, 9 key activities that the work plan, the BIL work plan was to implement. So again, the equity strategy is a way to determine whether or not benefits are flowing to these communities, but also advancing these 9 categories for us. So recreational access, climate resiliency, habitat restoration, infrastructure, engagement, outreach, and education, pollution reduction, carbon reductions, increasing local water supplies, and watershed-based partnerships. So those either apply or don't apply based upon our own sort of rubric, looking at what we're able to cause to happen with these given projects. Thank you. Next slide, please. So here are those 8 projects that were developed over of time frame of late 2021 into 2022. They are some of these are a little familiar. We've spoke about the kelp restoration work and the abalone work already today. The Santa Monica Breakwater Rocky Intertidal Preserve is a project that we're looking to fund support for environmental monitoring, coastal engineering and design to see if there's something that can be done to improve the ability of the Santa Monica Pier breakwater to be more resistant to more frequent intense wave energy events. I don't think we want to go back to the 80s when we watched the pier get knocked down by storm waves. So building a more resilient breakwater that may also have the multiple benefits of improving water quality in that area, long-standing challenge faced by the city and other partners to try to figure out how to improve the water quality around that pier. The pier is also used by a number of subsistence fishers, and I think that Catherine's program over at Gila Bay really helps elucidate how many folks are fishing off these piers and bringing protein back to their families. So if we do this smartly, we might be able to improve the habitat characteristics on the bottom of the ocean neighboring the pier, and improve the catch rates for these folks as well. So multifunctional, sort of multi-benefit approach to trying to deal with the breakwater. It was originally constructed in the early 30s, completed in like 1934. The Venice Marina Del Rey, Playa Del Rey Four Dune Beach Restoration Project. So here's an opportunity to create somewhere between 3 to 5 acres of coastal strand and dune along our coast, past projects, our most senior in the region being the Santa Monica pilot project, have shown that we can get dunes established, dune vegetation established, people respect that habitat. And it's been growing vertically and keeping pace with sea level rise for sure. It survived this past winter just fine. Other areas that had more exposure to that intense wave energy certainly saw more dynamic changes in the beach profile, as well as some of the erosion. Our list of reports that I'm trying to get out the door that I acknowledged were a little late will help inform those better before you in the coming weeks. So we don't have a site location for that. What we do know is that Venice, Marina Del Rey, Playa Del Rey is one of the most flood-prone areas due to the back beach configuration, the area behind it. I remind folks, when you walk to the beach in Venice, you're walking uphill out of Venice to get up to the beach. So we know that through a lot of different modeling, as well as just that physical aspect, that this is a place where we should probably get moving sooner than later to see if we can provide some real resilience to that region of our bay. The Adamson House Living Shoreline Project, is an effort to support state parks in looking at a cobbly berm living shoreline approach to basically create a slightly more vertical face there, have those cobbles disperse wave energy. When the waves come in, the rocks get tumbled, and then those large gaps between those cobbles allow the water to drain rapidly vertically downward. Once that water loses that elevation, it loses its energy, and when it returns back to the ocean, it doesn't scour the beach like it does when it bounces off of a traditional break wall. So it's been done in other places very successfully. This would be the first one I think that we're looking at in LA County. And in addition, what we're looking at is protecting, you know, three complementary components, all members of the National Historic Register, for midden deposits for the Chumash Village of Umalawu, the Adamson House and the Adamson House grounds, even the wall that's right there behind Surfrider Beach, being, you know, culturally significant. So hopefully this effort will protect that beach, protect those physical properties, and aid in public access around that point. Just a couple more here real quick, just reminding you folks, because it's been a year. Beach Management Certification Project. We understand that we're making changes to the beach, and the agencies and the folks that are out there providing services to this community on those beaches are going to have to adapt to these changes that we're putting forth. So we're working with agencies, LA County Beaches and Harbors, LA County Lifeguard, various municipalities, and in this case, notably with Karen Martin's leadership at Pepperdine University, to say, hey, here's some best practices around these dunes, around these features. And certainly as these projects may scale up to include far larger areas, this will be something that a nonprofit like the Bay Foundation is no longer able to maintain. So I think we're looking to see, you know, how we start finding folks like LA County Beaches and Harbors, et cetera, to look at their workforce, see how they have to retrain to approach the future of this coast with these features. Next one down is the Black Surfers Collective. This is a program that I've long personally been involved with. Absolute passion project for a few families here in Los Angeles who recognize that we've got socio-cultural and economic barriers to the BIPOC community going to our coast, feeling welcome, having the ability to enjoy coastal assets like the beach and surfing. So the intent here is to push away some of those barriers, engage these groups of people in swim lessons, cultural orientation to the beach that was once theirs as well, and overcoming in the past several decades of some pretty, you know, Jim Crow type era segregation practices here in Los Angeles. So excited to be supporting the Black Surfers Collective. And I think it's their efforts are absolutely at the core of what this equity strategy intends to cause for individuals. And then the last one on here is the Coastal Access and Beach Visitor User Data Study. What I would say is that we've got very coarse information about how many people are on our coast, who they are, where they came from, and we have to recognize how valuable from any number of factors these beaches and this coastline is. When I have to summarize this in an elevator speech, I'm like, Los Angeles without a beach, you know, it's like, what, New York without a Central Park? I don't know how you have LA without a beach, but that's what we're in jeopardy of if we don't get moving. So with this project, what we'll be able to do working with partners is gather 5 years worth of cell phone data, tie those data back to that cell phone and its owner and their address, and we can start to paint a very detailed picture of who is coming to our beaches, where they are on our beach, how long they're there. We can tie that to various coastal assets for access or piers or jetties or breakwaters, and really encouraged to see what these data reveal. And much of our tracking benefits for our equity strategy is going to come back to some of these data applied forward in future efforts to update those cell phone data and understand the trends. Part of what really sparked this was COVID, and when the beaches were closed, other access points to the coast were found because folks were trying to get out there, and we saw big shifts in where people started showing up at the beach, and it just recognized that this is not a static environment, and it also, I think, underscored that people were very desperately trying to get outside and find some socialization and respite from the stress of that period. Which further underscored the need for this work. Sorry, I know that one took a little while. Next slide, please. All right, so having oriented you to this thus far, four of these projects out of those eight were ones that at the Bay Foundation we thought really did have the opportunity to not only benefit disadvantaged communities, but give us an opportunity to actually estimate the flow of those benefits to disadvantaged communities. And the Breakwater Rocky Intertidal Preserve is one of those. I won't repeat all of those reasons, but here you are laid out in a table as well in the equity strategy that was circulated to you before this meeting. Next slide, please. The Adamson Living Shoreline project was another that we thought had these same capacities for the reasons that I had described to you just in the previous, well, two slides back. Next one, please. Black Surfers Collective. And lastly, the Coastal Access and Beach Visitor User Data Study. That one just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't it? All right. So then getting close to the end here. So this was our estimate. Based upon what these investments would look like. I think there's a lot going on at the Santa Monica Pier. There's a lot of people visiting the Santa Monica Pier for a lot of purposes, and I don't want to pretend or suggest that everyone at the pier is originating or living in a disadvantaged community. So we felt that 50% of this investment could be assigned to this as a target. And then we'll use those other data collection means to see how close we get to that number when it comes to folks visiting the pier, benefiting from the potential outputs of the creation of that Rocky Intertidal Preserve. The Adamson House, I think for the resident assets that are there, those cultural aspects and the natural historic register, et cetera, underscore the importance of that site, as well as the very serious interruption of services to the community there, because right now there's very little beach left It's very difficult for lifeguards to get across the breach of the lagoon. So it's causing a lot of issues that I think are can be aided through that project. So again, the benefits of protecting that site and the other services that this project could build future for future resilience, put this one up at a 90% estimate. The Black Surface Collective, similar to what I shared with you earlier, I think that this program engages, provides recreation, provides access, and thusly we thought that a 90% estimate was appropriate. And seeing how that coastal access and beach visitor user data study being led by folks at a Cal State University, Channel Islands, and a few other partners is really, I think, the linchpin for us proving out that some of our thinking behind this is actually the case. And I think we're getting close, very close to the end. Here's where we swing into SB 535. So again, you know, maybe just to speak from a personal standpoint, I'm a marine ecologist. I am not a sociologist or a social scientist who, you know, has a depth of understanding of the public health implications of this, et cetera. So we, again, drew from the wonderful resources that this state makes available. I can assure you that many of my fellow National Estuary Programs in other states around this country did not have such resources to pull on to inform their strategies. But here's what SB 535, you know, summarizes, you know, pollution burden and exposure, pollution burden and environmental effects, population characteristics, sensitive populations. There's a bunch of subscript on this that you'll see elsewhere, and population characteristics and socioeconomic factors that all contribute to whether or not you are in a designated disadvantaged community based upon this actions of this legislation. Next slide, please. So if you do use CalEnviro Screen, I think it's pretty straightforward to access through your, you know, sitting there at home, sitting there at work and diving in. In this map, what you'll see is the sort of northern section of our study area in purple. The red areas that you see are census tracts from the 2020 census that are identified by SB 535 is disadvantaged. And so then we used their definition to define these areas within our study area here in Santa Monica Bay. Next slide, please. More of a picture of the central bay. So folks that are maybe out there following online, we're sort of looking at something from around Malibu Surf Rider Beach, swinging around just south of the airport into El Segundo, maybe northern Manhattan Beach. And you can see the expanse of the DAC here overlaid with the study area. Next
Tom,
slide.
Sorry, can I interject for a moment? Can you explain the coloring and shading on this map, please?
Yes. So the red areas, be they superimposed over the purple shaded area, are census tract blocks or an amalgam of them that identify using the CalEnviro Screen tool as a disadvantaged community. So those are census tracts. And if you zoom in, I know it's very hard to see on our screens here before us, you'll see all those individual census tracts. So there's hundreds of them. The purple shaded area in this case is the terrestrial watershed boundary that is used by the Santa Monica Bay National Estuary Program for its study area. So this is a place that we are intended to focus our efforts and investments of EPA 320 funds and now BIL funds to provide benefits back to this community. So they do overlap, as you see, and certainly that study area at this point in these projections does not include the bay itself or those nearshore offshore waters that will be included in other portrayals. There's no communities living out there over the water. Does that help, Luke?
Yes, thank you.
All right, you got it. And then proceeding down towards the South Bay, we can see again, where the DAC communities are identified based to, you know,
Manhattan, Hawthorne, Redondo, Torrance, the Palos Verdes Peninsula along the coastline there. And we're looking at, you know, Wilmington, Carson, Lomita, Gardena, Hawthorne, as some of the that DAC community that you see represented herein. And we're getting close to this is what it looks like all put together. I would say that part of the what this view also showed us was that, you know, disadvantaged communities, as identified, don't live directly along the coastline. And yet to assume that these folks don't use those resources or don't benefit from them, I think would be naive. However, as I said, we don't have a lot of hard answers on where people are going, where they're coming from, how they're using the coastline. And we're hoping that that study will help bring that picture better into focus. And I look at this not just to satisfy this strategy or to help inform the BIL long-term plan. What I hope it shows all of us around this room, folks far afield, is that there's tens of millions of visitors that need this coastline to be here for generations to come. And that when we are reaching out for support, be that financial, be that technical, be that otherwise, that, you know, this is a place that well deserves it, and verily requires it. So I hope that this whole program helps lead us to some of those conclusions. And I think that's my final slide, minus the closer.
Yes. Hi, I had a couple of questions. Since I didn't seem to receive that report in my email packet, or I missed it, concerning our historic Santa Monica breakwater, if I could have that part of the presentation or the background information emailed to me, that would be helpful, because I didn't have that before the meeting. And our breakwater obviously is near and dear to my heart, being a council member in Santa Monica. And secondly, the Black Surfers Collective is also something that is near and dear. We had Inkwell Beach on Pico and Bay Street at the beach, and it was a intentional segregated area. And we have annually a Nick Galbadon Day, and I just mispronounced his name, which I always do, but and the Black Surfers Collective is part of that annual event. So I'd like to get more information on both of those, please. And the last question I have is, when you're talking about collecting data, that seemed really specific in terms of you want names, you want addresses, et cetera, of where everyone's coming from to the beach. And as much as we're all now in a society where, you know, every time you step anywhere from your bathroom to your living room, someone knows. At the same time, that seems really specific. So I want to make sure, are there safeguards on the collection of that data to provide more information on where the people are coming from to our beaches? Thank you.
So first, Caitlin, can we make sure that we provide access to all the board members of the strategy?
Absolutely. We'll send a copy of the presentation slides as follow-up materials.
Great. And before I go on, Tom, do you have a response to the privacy issues associated with gathering data on names and addresses?
Yes, I think I can provide some input to that. So Phil, we're not doing anything with anybody's data that they haven't either knowingly or unknowingly allowed with their phone already. So this is publicly available data that is out there. It is not going to be in the possession of the Bay Foundation. It's going to be in the possession of research lab at Cal State University Channel Islands, who has all of those types of procedures about how you handle socially sensitive individual type data. There will never be a pathway
into that data that is publicly available. That's going to be like, oh, and here's Phil's favorite fishing spot on the beach. Phil goes here. But I think that the power that this project's could bring is maybe worth some of those. I don't know how to say it. I don't think a lot of people like the idea that I know where they're going and what they're doing based upon where they're showing up at the beach. But we don't intend to maybe glamorize that. It will be something that's dealt with in aggregate in the presentation of this. And we're building off of a project that was done by the National Estuary Program in Rhode Island that used these same approaches and were able to guarantee those same types.
Can we make sure
services.
That you have that disclaimer that every time you mention that project, you should say that the safeguards on the project, because even though we're in the process in Santa Monica of installing cameras and drones and everything else, and we know that, you know, everyone's watched everywhere, my spidey sense went up right then and said, wait a minute, you know, it sounded oppressive. So if you could make sure that when you make your future presentations, at least you mention that there are safeguards in place, that would be helpful. Thank you.
So Phil, we had quite a long discussion about this a couple of years ago, as I remember, on when this was first proposed. And I believe that in the project description, if we could make that available for folks, the reassurance is that this is not that the foundation doesn't actually track people's attendance. It's a aggregate statistical analysis that's done by the university. And I don't know if we have that available directly, Caitlin, but if we could work with the foundation to make the project description from available for Phil and anyone for the board members, that would be useful. Thank you. Any other? Yes, Brock.
First of all, thank you for the presentation and everything that's going on. It all seems very interesting. The question I had is, earlier in today's meeting, you had mentioned sort of in passing managed retreat, and I was just wondering if that is part of any of these projects or a potential future component of any of these projects, because obviously, you know, the ensuring access, if the erosion controls and stuff don't work, then the only way to ensure access is to make sure that there's still a beach, meaning you have to move stuff back. And so I was just curious if that's part of it as well.
Yeah, so when I was speaking of managed retreat, it was certainly of interest of the NEP program nationally to have that as a potential project or foci for our spring meeting in DC. So that would be with the EPA, other federal agencies, and the National Estuary Programs. I don't have an appreciation or an understanding for a, quote, managed retreat policy or practices that are in place here in California or within the county of Los Angeles. I think...
Tom, yep. You're just rambling. So let's... The answer is no.
Well, I didn't want to give him an answer like my kids give me an answer, John, so I was trying to explain to him. That's what it was in reference to, and no. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. Thanks, Tom. Two questions interrelated, and you started to address them. When I read the document, thank you for that, the equity strategy document, I noticed in one of your presentation slides, it was a little different. It looks like the coastal part of disadvantaged communities was de-emphasized in your presentation, because when I was reading through it, I said, is it only coastal? And this relates to the second question, which is that how do we, because I know the county's had trouble with this over the years in some of our projects, how do you establish the equity benefits of the beach?
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So I have to take a second to get it all back up going again, and we'll be back on in 5 minutes.
Okay. And I didn't mean to cut you off, but we are running very late, and we need to try and...
So the only issue, we lost video connectivity for just a second. We'll have to get it back going, but we are still broadcasting. We're still streaming. Audio is still going out, so we can still hear everything. Just video, getting our video signal. So everything is still streaming. We can continue.
Great. So we're going to continue the meeting, even though we're, and folks that are watching, you won't see us, but you can hear us. Mostly because we're running a little late and we need to keep moving. Clark, go ahead.
So the question is, this is you're identifying in your kind of current projects or current plan projects, the equity benefits. And I'm really interested to see how the National Estuary Program and others identify this challenge, which is that the beach on any given weekend is thousands of census tracts, right? And it's and yet on the map, it's census tracts connected to the adjacent development, which, as your illustration shows, is very generally mostly not disadvantaged community. So thank you for that. Would really like to hear how that goes, and if standards could come out for identifying the larger community benefit of the beach and the shoreline. And then the second thing is, if those benefits to disadvantaged communities are insufficient for this body to define projects, I was interested to see that the coastal word, coastal community, coastal disadvantaged coastal community has been changed in the presentation to disadvantaged community, because I think we're logically going to have to look inland a little bit, even though we're challenged in this region to find habitat restoration, recreational access projects that are not coastal. So I just wanted to raise those two issues and see what you're thinking on that.
I'll be very brief. I think you're asking all the exact questions that we're asking, Clark. And I think that what we find as the challenge in this is that defining that beach benefits the folks that only live right next to it is an incorrect characterization, and that who benefits from those coastal assets, or what is a coastal community based upon that, is far wider ranging than the picture that these tools presented. But without the extra effort, we'll never know. So that's what we're going for. I appreciate your thoughts on the matter. I'm right there with you.
Aaron?
Thank you. Very briefly, I want to concur with what I just heard from Clark and those challenges. One thing I didn't hear, and that I don't believe is really captured in Calenviro's screen, I may be mistaken, there may be experts in this room that know it better than I do, is extreme heat and heat burden, which is something that we're seeing a lot of, especially, take, say, Azuma Beach in Malibu. That is the most popular beach for folks from the San Fernando Valley, which is one of the most heat-burdened parts of LA County. And I just want to call out that LA County's climate vulnerability assessment prepared, I think, 2 years ago, does an excellent job of mapping those heat risks. And I think that could be an additional layer for all of us to incorporate in. And there is a climate vulnerability initiative that is really launching this year at the county that will provide additional data. So thank you.
And Megan, Martha.
Okay, Megan first. Hi, thank you. I just wanted to mention, it's not a question, but I do think that we can do a better job of involving more disadvantaged communities directly in our coastal projects and where they don't necessarily live, but as we've all been talking about, are benefiting from. And I think we need to be pulling away a little bit of our project money and putting that money directly toward organizations that are based in, are serving, are staffed by people who are living in disadvantaged communities and benefiting from the coastal environments, and finding ways to really allow them, help us drive these projects forward, help us shape these projects, and provide directly a benefit in a way, a mechanism for them to be involved. And we have some examples of how we're doing that in some of our projects. I just want to mention that.
I'm going to take the chair's prerogative and say, this is exactly what I was thinking when I talked about the CCMP, is that if we want to make part of our vision, our priorities is to actually pull in disadvantaged communities from the inland areas to access the coastal, we make that part of our priorities, and then we build that into the work plans as we move forward. That's just a example. Sorry. Martha.
And mine is a comment on the beach management certification project. I think when I read the description, it's not really a certification. I think it's development of best management practices that agencies can use. So just kind of maybe reconsider the name on that, because it implies something that maybe is not your intent. Ideally, once these best management practices are developed, people you find them useful and actually implement them.
Thank you, Martha. I would like to remind you that this has already been approved and moved forward, so they're not going to be changing the names of anything. Catherine.
I had a question. I'm really excited about the results of the beach visitor study. I think there's a lot of implications for, you know, projects across the bay. So I'm excited for that. And wonder in terms of the percentages. So when you determine those percentages, like 50%, 90%, are those all coming, will those all come from the beach visitor data? Or is it kind of a bit of a, you know, some of that information will inform the 50% at the Santa Monica Pier? I guess I wasn't totally sure how you came up with those percentages. And then also, you know, what if you find that there's, it's wildly different than you thought? Is that going to impact, you know, your funding or EPA's kind of approval of this?
And Erica, perhaps if you can help me jog my memory, we were asked to be both reasonable and aspirational simultaneously in this. So I think we honestly gave it our best educated guess. That I won't have answers till I start to see the data products coming out of this to best answer that. I also don't know how to put a price tag on the Adamson House or the Midden deposits from that Chumash village, other than say I probably worth all of it. There's certainly subjectivity in this, even though we're dealing with some hard numbers, because that's what was requested of us. So we'll do our best to keep informing it.
Thank you for that question, Catherine. And we also did ask more of Tom and staff to, so I think at the very end, there is some verbiage. It's talking about what Tom just said, kind of explaining the percentages. And I think you accurately captured what EPA was asking for. I had one other point and I forgot it. The money, so the strategy has been approved. That means there is a match waiver for the coming until 2026 for this bill funding. And as long as work is being implemented and you're approving work plans, the money isn't going to be drawn back. I mean, I can't say what Congress is going to do in the future, but we're moving ahead. Thank you.
So I'm going to cut this off at this point. Sorry, I think this is really important stuff, but we have only 25 minutes left, and we still have the presentation on the restoration that we need to move forward with. So I appreciate the enthusiasm, and let's keep that enthusiasm going as we go through our process of planning for next year. Caitlin? Luke?
Oh. So moving on to the next item. So this item 4B is a presentation by California State Parks staff on the Malibu Creek Ecosystem Restoration Project, which is part of our CCMP Action 9. The project involves the removal of the decommissioned Ringe Dam along Malibu Creek and approximately 780,000 cubic yards of sediment behind the dam, and modification or removal of 8 upstream barriers along various creeks within the Malibu Creek watershed. When completed, the project will restore creek ecosystem functions, increase habitat connectivity, restore habitat to benefit the endangered Southern California steelhead and many other benefits. The project is currently in the pre-construction engineering and design phase, so we thought it was a good opportunity to hear an update about the project and how equitable community engagement and outreach are being conducted as it moves forward. Danielle LaFleur, who represents state parks on our governing board, has provided updates on this project many times in the past. During our meeting, she couldn't join us today, but we're grateful to her to help us organize this presentation. And I see we're having, okay, I do have presentation slides to share. Okay. And we're grateful to our presenter, RJ Van Sant. RJ is a senior environmental scientist with the Angeles District of California State Parks and project manager for the Malibu Creek Ecosystem Restoration Project. And we'll be sure to send a copy of the slides as follow-ups after the meeting. And as a reminder, we will hold public comment following RJ's presentation, then move to member comments. And we did receive one request in advance to comment on this item. So if the tech is ready, I will go ahead. Okay. I will start sharing my screen. There's a little bit of a delay. Bear with us. Apologies, RJ. I see you have joined us virtually.
Yeah, can you hear me okay and see me okay?
We can hear you. We're having a little bit of tech issue, so unfortunately we cannot see you just yet. Just give us one moment. Apologies.
Yeah, no worries.
Okay. RJ, can you let us know if you see our the slides?
Yeah, I can see it.
Should we move forward?
Yeah, just ask.
Okay, if you're ready to present, we can just get started considering the time. And I can advance the slides. Fortunately, everyone here in the room. Okay, here we go. Okay, looks like we're good. Okay, RJ. You have the floor.
All right. Well, thanks for inviting me. I know some of you there have heard this presentation, so apologies if it's a repeat. I changed some of the slides, so hopefully there's a little bit of interest with that. But yeah, as you mentioned, so I'm RJ Van Sant with California State Parks, and I'm the project manager for this Malibu Creek Ecosystem Restoration Project, which is a really exciting project that State Parks is undertaking to, as you mentioned, remove Range Dam, which is shown here in the intro slide, and then eight upstream barriers along some other tributaries to Malibu Creek. So next slide, please. So if we take a step back a little bit and look at the larger picture, the larger area. So we're in the Malibu Creek watershed shown here and outlined in yellow. You can see Range Dam is that southern little white box. And then the other upstream barriers are those other boxes within the watershed. And so you can see the project is focused mostly in the southern-ish area of the watershed below the 101 freeway. Next, please. So the Malibu Creek watershed, a little bit of a couple of facts. It's always good to take a step back and know where you're at and the larger concept, context of the project. So two-thirds of the watershed is actually in LA County and a third is in Ventura County. It's about 110 square miles of drainage area, so it's actually a pretty small watershed, considering the larger context and the larger watersheds we have, but it's actually the second largest in Santa Monica Bay next to Biona Creek, and then there's about 90,000 residents within the watershed. Next slide. So why is this watershed important? What's unique about it? Why do we care about it? And I think a big portion or big reason why this watershed is unique is because of the large amount of open space. It's about 75% undeveloped, 25% developed, and a big reason of that is a large area is within the Santa Monica Mountains National Recreation Area that's administered by the National Park Service. And then Malibu Creek State Park is also a big area. And then there's some there's also other conserved lands, open space lands within it. But we have lots of conserved land, which is really unique, and especially considering the close proximity to LA and the highly developed area. It's also within this biodiversity hotspot we have in Southern California. So there's about 4,000 plus or minus species in LA County, and 52 of those are endangered or so in the larger county. But it's got lots of species that are endemic, so they don't occur anywhere else in the world except for in this area. And then a lot of them are also threatened or endangered. There's also lots of cultural and historic resources. So Native American tribes have been within the greater Santa Monica Mountains for 7,000 plus years, maybe even longer, and more current historic, like Spanish ranchos, homesteaders, adobe, constructed, things like that, and the more modern film industry with lots of filming of TV shows and movies in the area. And it's really key area for many, many species, in particular many that are unfortunately endangered or threatened. So species like steelhead, which is really a key species of this project, but also red-legged frog, tidewater goby, pond turtle, etc. So lots of species in this watershed that really rely on the watershed. And then at the southern end of the watershed, we have Surf Rider Beach, so very high tourism, very iconic surf break that's on the National Register of Historic Places. And then you have Malibu Lagoon, which is one of the last few remaining estuaries in LA County. Next slide, please. So if we zoom in a little bit about the project specifically, so Ringe Dam is located about 3 miles from the coast, upstream or north of Malibu Lagoon. Within Malibu Creek, it's in this really steep and narrow canyon. On that smaller photo there, you can see the dam right there in the middle in Malibu Canyon Road on the left-hand side. And it's also within Malibu Creek State Park. And it's in this bend in the river that actually has these rock outcrops that naturally had narrowed the river in that location, which is a good reason why they constructed it. There was strong rock structure, you know, rock outcrops that were able to be used to anchor that dam. Next slide. And then if we look at the upstream barriers, so this is another key component. It's not as large or grandiose as the dam, but it's really important actually, because these upstream barriers, which are a few different road crossings, culverts, small impediments, actually are really critical to get more stream miles for steelhead and other species to be able to access those areas. So these are on Cold Creek and Los Virginas Creek. And if we didn't incorporate these and we were just doing the dam removal, the dam removal alone would get us about 5 miles of habitat within Malibu Creek. But incorporating these other crossings gets us an additional 10 on top of that. So we get about 15 additional miles of access with both of these combined. Next slide, please. So a little bit about Ringe Dam. So it was built from 1924 to 1926 by May Ringe. So it was actually built by the wife of Frederick Ringe and the Ringe family, who owned this huge rancho within Malibu, and is actually constructed after the husband had passed away. May Ringe is a pretty strong, passionate, hardworking woman, and so she had this constructed for private, personal water storage. So it wasn't a flood control, it wasn't a reservoir. Well, I guess it was a reservoir for their own private use. So they had a water line that went all the way down the canyon to their home for alfalfa and beans and some other crops. The dam is about 100 feet tall and 140 feet wide, and it consists of really two parts. So on the right side of the top photo is the dam, it's this arch, concrete arch structure, and then the left side is the spillway. It's about 12 feet thick at the base and 2 feet thick at the top, Unfortunately for the Ringe family, it filled with sediment within about 20 years or pretty close to it. So they lost about 80% capacity really quickly. And it's not something they, I'm sure, expected. And I like to think if they would have known how quickly it would fill up, I don't know that they would have constructed it. That photo at the right, bottom right, is from 1949. You can see the reservoir of water is pretty small already. It's already mostly filled with sediment at that point. It did still serve some water supply function until about the 1960s. But after that, it was pretty much useless. There were numerous attempts to remove sediment or try and alleviate the sedimentation issue. None of them that were super successful. And so in 1967, it was officially decommissioned. And then in 76, it was acquired as part of the larger Malibu Creek State Park. Next. So we're fortunate. We have some pretty unique and pretty cool photos from the Division of Safety of Dams, who were involved somewhat during the construction of it. So the top left photo is from a photo from 1925 that shows the dam, but before the spillway was actually constructed. So there's a pen outline that shows where the spillway was going to be constructed. That top left, I'm not sure who drew that in and at what point, but pretty cool. And there's lots of other photos. The one on the bottom left showing the dam, there was actually a dam keeper's house up on the left abutment up there. Yeah, right there. That's not there. I actually want to go up there and see if there's any remnants, because there probably is of some amount, but it's not the easiest thing to get up. And then the big topographic map we have here is actually from the original geologist engineer Wayne Lowell, so this is showing the topography pre-dam, which is pretty cool to know what the creek looked like, where it flowed, how wide or narrow it was. It's pretty pretty nice. And then we have plans of the actual dam itself, so that's really useful in deconstruction, knowing what it's composed of, the thicknesses, what material, etc. So it's really convenient and nice to be able to have these accessible to us. Next. All right, so what are we doing? What's the actual description, project description? So simply put, removal of the dam and the spillway and about 780,000 cubic yards of sediment behind the dam. The EIR, EIS that was completed in 2020 was a joint document with the Army Corps of Engineers, who was the federal lead, and State Parks, who was the state lead. That document and what is outlined as the final project, if you will, is to remove the dam incrementally over about 7 to 8 years. So they would remove about 10 feet of sediment a year, remove 10 feet of the dam, wait till winter passes, come back, remove the next 10 feet, the next 10 feet of sediment, etc. And so this would be done by, you know, mechanical equipment trucking out all this sediment. And so about 2/3 of the sediment would go to the landfill. About 1/3 would be used for beach nourishment, which is considered beach compatible in the eyes of that document. We're looking, and I'll go into a little more detail, but we're looking into other methods and other alternatives to this mechanical removal. It's not something we think there's probably some better ways to do it and some better options. So we're going to be looking into that, and over the next year or so, and some pretty extensive looking at that. And then we're also, as I had mentioned, there's 8 upstream barriers. So those photos on the bottom left are just a few of them. They're on Las Virgenes and Cold Creeks. So these are mostly culverts. There's a White Oak Dam, which is actually a small little dam also, but these are mostly to improve for fish passage. Next slide. So that sediment removal, as I mentioned, so the current plan is to actually truck it north to Calabasas Landfill, that material that's not beach compatible, to take the other material to potentially Ventura area, put it on a barge, bring it back down shore, and place it just offshore near Malibu Pier, the actual material that is beach compatible. But we're going to be looking into other more economical, other options that we think are just more suitable, make more sense. One is a natural transport, which is happening with a lot of the dams, Klamath River dams, which are coming down right now. Condit Dam in Washington, where you're cutting holes potentially in the dam, or you're notching it, things like that. You know, all that material that's built up behind that dam, that 780,000 cubic yards would have made its way down the creek to the ocean, to the near shore anyway, without the dam. So it's all material that would have made it there anyway. So we have some challenges in just letting it, you know, we can't just let it rip and cut it down. You know, unfortunately there's downstream infrastructure and houses and commercial that we have to worry about flooding issues, but we're going to take a harder look, and we're doing some updated modeling to really get a better handle on the sediment transport and where that material was going if we did do a more natural transport. We're also going to look at a pipeline potential option. You know, if there's option to actually pipe that in like a slurry offshore, and that could help with alleviate any flooding issues with that sediment, if it would naturally come downstream and build up the creek and cause flooding issues. So that could be helpful with that. It'd also be helpful with downstream species and limiting impact to any species in the creek if we did that more natural option. Next slide. All right, so there's quite a few objectives and benefits to the project. The one big overarching one is just restoring ecosystem function. So as you can imagine, a dam is altering hydrology, altering sediment transport. So getting those natural processes back, getting the sediment moving downstream as it should. You know, these species are very adapted to this very flashy system of water flow and sediment movement we have in Southern California. And they've been adapted and thriving to that for, you know, millions of years. And any alteration or change that really causes issues. So if we can get some of that more natural function back, it's really beneficial. And then increasing connectivity from a aquatic movement, you know, in the water, like steelhead, to even a more terrestrial species. So, you know, species like deer, coyote, mountain lion, bobcat, raccoon, you know, et cetera. And anything that's uses the stream corridor for movement, which is a substantial number of species, even non-aquatic species. So that dam is obviously a physical impediment. So removing that is really useful for habitat connectivity. And it would reconnect 15 miles of stream that has been inaccessible for 100 years, or just about 100 years. So that getting all that mileage back would be really beneficial to a number of species. The restoring transport of natural sediment really helps with coastal resiliency. You know, was talked about earlier, and is such a big topic of climate change and sea level rise and coastal resiliency. And our beaches are they're so starved of sediment that they need. And so getting rid of that dam, hopefully putting some of that material back out in the coastal zone and getting that natural transport happening should help with coastal resiliency and climate change issues. It's also a public safety issue. There's been quite a few deaths and injuries of people jumping off the spillway or the areas of the dam. So removing that risk potentially, it serves no function at all, really. So there's no flood control. It's 100% or basically 100% full of sediment right now. So there's no storage capacity. It's not holding water. It's not holding sediment. There's no use to it really at all. And then from a little bit broader context, the project is really complementary to the 30 by 30 initiative. So the, you know, preserving 30% of the state's lands by 2030. And it's mentioned specifically in the steelhead recovery plan in the most recent 5-year review for Southern California steelhead that Ringe and many other dams are really a problem, and their removal is really beneficial to steelhead. Next slide. So like any big project, there's a number of challenges for sure. So the sediment issue, like I mentioned, is really a key one. What we're going to do with the sediment, where it's going to go from not only a cost, but a pollution standpoint of trucks, truck traffic. It's about 7 to 8 years of construction with this mechanical removal. Trucks would be about 90 trucks a day, tapering down to 40 trucks a day for 150 days a year. So it's a lot of truck traffic. It's a lot of greenhouse gas emissions, a lot of pollution, unnecessarily, most likely. So really looking at better options. we have species in the lagoon and downstream that we really need to be cognizant of and sure we're not causing any issues. Cost, of course, is an issue like with any restoration project or big restoration project. So it's estimated with this mechanical removal, it's about $280 million for deconstruction. So that's a big cost. And then, as I mentioned before, downstream flooding. So the key ones are the Malibu business area down near the lagoon. And then this photo here of the flooding is Cross Creek Bridge. So that Sarah Retreat community is already, they're in flood zones. They're already dealing with flooding. They're going to be dealing with flooding with or without this project into the future, unfortunately for them. We just want to make sure we're not exacerbating any of that flooding and causing more issues. Next slide. Okay, so where have we been? Where are we going? Where are we? So the timeline here, the red dots are mostly what's been completed. Yellow is our current stage and green is the future. So the key ones really here are 2020, the environmental impact report and our environmental impact statement. So the state and federal environmental documents were complete, which was a big step. In 2021, we actually got $12.5 million from the state legislature allocated for the phase we're in right now. So we have this $12.5 million to get us to 90% design and permitting of the project. So none of that is actual implementation or construction, which will be funding we'll be looking for and looking into in the very near future. We had our first kickoff meeting, public meeting in May of this year for this phase of the project. And then we're currently doing lots of different technical studies and design work. So we're doing geotech work. Actually, within the next month or so, they're going to be, we'll be out there. Our consultant crew will be doing some additional borings of the sediment behind the dam to see what's there. There's some existing ones, but they wanted some additional information. So there'll be some big helicopters dropping equipment down in there and people. So that'll be actually really interesting to see coming up, like I said, the next month. And then within the next year or so, we're going to be doing baseline, redoing some modeling. We have some more advanced and newer models for hydrology, hydraulics, and sediment transport that we think are going to probably tell a different story than the current models that were done. And we'll be doing that for baseline and then for some alternatives. And then also doing the design, getting to 35 and 65% design for the upstream barriers. So the plan is to get the upstream barriers under construction or deconstruction before the dam. One, they're just smaller, it's easier. And then also it helps with any impacts to endangered species downstream of the dam. If the dam's in place and we're doing the upstream barriers, we don't have to worry about that as much. And then 2026, 2027 is when we get to from 35 to 90% design for the dam itself. And then we're hopeful that deconstruction would be in 2027 and 2028 or so. Next slide. And that's so it's a rendering of what we're hoping what the creek will look like once the dam is down, a more natural flow and processes and ecosystem function happening. We also are doing lots of outreach. California Trout is a big partner of ours right now, and they're spearheading a lot of the outreach. So they're doing as much outreach from tabling events to, we were just at the Malibu Farmers Market a couple of weeks ago. So getting the word out, getting public support, getting public involvement, just getting people to know and be aware and be supportive and wanted to be involved in any way possible of the project. It's a super important part that I think we've learned at state parks in particular, but it's just important for any project really is really getting public involvement, public engagement, and getting them supportive if you can and involved. So that's it for me.
Thank you very much. Caitlin, I believe we have a public commenter.
We did have one person request to provide public comment, but she's not physically here or in our Zoom meeting at this time.
Okay. Then at that point, I'll turn it over. Are there questions or comments from any of the board members that you can do in 10 seconds or less? Okay. Thank you all. We are going to make it. I appreciate your indulgence in getting us through. And I believe that our next board meeting is in December.
Yes, our next board meeting is December 14th, and that will be at the Delray Yacht Club. So again, Delray Yacht Club, where we were last meeting, not here.
Dean.
Thank you. There was a comment earlier by a board member about getting information to us ahead of time, so I'd appreciate when we have these information items, if as much we could be provided ahead of time on some backup information before the meeting.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
All right, in that case, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you all.